It is time for the Media Beat. David Tarachuk joins us every Friday morning. We rebroadcast it over the weekend and also after our 12 noon news during the following week. David is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. His own website, themediabeat.us, is a terrific space to go to. And once again, we welcome David from the far northern reaches of our area, and that is Maine. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. It's good to be joining the ever-incisive Marshall Miles from not my normal perch in the media capital of the world, New York City, but yes, up in among the bird life of Maine, the great state of Maine.
You know, we have, over the past week and a half, the media's been constantly going between hurricanes in Haiti, what's going on in Afghanistan, what's going on in Washington, what's going on with the Taliban. I mean, it has been a week and a half that has been relentless.
Relentless indeed, yeah. It's hard to know as a news editor what to emphasize most, what where to put your priorities. But I guess Afghanistan has loomed largest of all, and not surprisingly, after 20 years of our military presence there and much toing and froing about how the war was being conducted, becoming known eventually as the Forever War, the longest war, in fact, that the United States has engaged in, along with its allies, particularly my old home country of UK, but other NATO allies as well, who have had to take the cue from the Americans and also leave, on the accelerated time program that President Biden insisted on, using the looming 20th anniversary of September 11th, of course, as the deadline. And the wisdom of that is now what is being criticized very thoroughly across the broad, the broad span of many journalistic outlets, even ones that normally support Biden, and it's not surprising because inevitably the images that are coming out that are so expressive of complete chaos, there's an awful lot of some kind of questioning of Biden's position, but more than that, it's probably the sharpest criticism that he's had in the, what is it now, just a little over 200 days of his presidency, and it's, you know, it's perfectly understandable. We have been seeing images and hearing the experiences of individuals that make us in no doubt at all that however well-intentioned the withdrawal may have been, its actual conduct has been so chaotic. There are many people who say that it was inevitable, including, interestingly enough, the president himself. He has shifted position, interestingly, in his media appearances over this past week. The early part of the week, his essential message was, I didn't know the Taliban would take over so quickly. Well, we must ponder that. But then in his ABC interview on Thursday with George Stephanopoulos, he changed his position, and it becomes, in effect, I did know. But I couldn't have done anything about it, that chaos was inevitable. His actual words was the idea that somehow there's a way to have gotten out without chaos ensuing. I don't know how that could happen. That's a pretty devastating admission, I think. And inevitably, across the world, the media has been highly critical of his carrying out of a decision which was probably long overdue, but nonetheless people are being very hard at him, probably justifiably, for allowing on his watch such pandemonium to break out and such chaos to prevail.
You know, but I sit here as someone who is old enough to where I was eligible to be drafted to go into Vietnam. I've seen the end of our operations in Vietnam. I've seen the United States go into other areas of the world, and I keep bringing this back up to remind people, in the first Gulf War, where we went to war to get Iraq out of another country, we also went into that war with the full support of just about the entire world except for that one country. And when it was successful at the end, there were people that wanted our general to march on Baghdad, and he stated quite plainly that was not the mission we were assigned. The mission we were assigned were to get an invading country out of another country. We've succeeded at that.
The other country being Kuwait, of course.
We've succeeded at that. And, you know, when you think about our entry into Afghanistan to get rid of Al-Qaeda and to find the people that were responsible for 9/11, we finally did reach that goal. But, you know, as a country, sometimes our politicians, our presidents, and this is Republican and Democrat, it doesn't matter, get a little confused along the way, thinking that you can take our democracy and somehow modify it, and especially in a country like Afghanistan, which has been totally unrulable by one particular brand of government just about for its entire history.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are so many people, so many major powers, that is, in the world that have tried to take Afghanistan and turn it into something that they would like to see it become. And that applies way back to Victorian Britain and Tsarist Russia fighting it out. The term for the competition was called the Great Game, with a certain kind of grim irony. It's as if Russia didn't learn any lessons from it, because as the USSR, they came back in the late 20th century and tried to mold Afghanistan to its own liking then, with an internal communist party, but then in the end a form of what has been called the Soviet Union's Vietnam, when they went in militarily and eventually had to come out with their tails between their legs, not unlike America relieving Vietnam. And the same has been true of just about everyone who has tried to get Afghanistan to become what they want it to become. And as you say, there was a limited mission when America and its allies went in October, November of 2001, and they've suffered, of course, from that term which I first learned when I was with United Nations peacekeeping missions. I worked with the UN for a long time, as you know, and mission creep was the phrase, and that happens so often, especially with big military operations. They almost feed upon themselves and become an entity unto themselves. And regime change was involved in the early days. Regime change. We got a new government in Afghanistan. We the allies of the West, led by the United Nations, trained up a whole new army. At the same time, we're never able really to turn it into the mirror image of a Western democracy and its military force. That I think, although people wouldn't say it at the time, was what they were trying to do. And in the end, as you say, it was a case of overreach, and overreach is almost by definition going to turn out as a complete failure. One of the interesting phrases was from the Biden interview, was one of again just a terrible admission. President Biden was making it clear that he was confident that he would get all the American citizens, both diplomats and other non-diplomatic aid organization type American citizens out of Afghanistan by his by the workable deadline of the very end of August, in good time to meet that anniversary of September 11, of course. But he was not at all sure about the Afghans who wanted to leave, especially the Afghans to whom we owe this responsibility of them having supported us and helped us and worked for us directly in some cases, indirectly in other cases. And about these other abandoned Afghans, he said, we're having some more difficulty helping them who helped us when we were in there. And that's, as I say, that's a terrible admission. And it's one of the strains that you see through all the coverage. There's a sense of outrage about America performing this role, this somewhat paternalistic role of turning Afghanistan into a different kind of society. A laudable aim in many ways, but not one that an outside power can ever do it itself. But those people who did buy into it and who are part of it are now being shamefully abandoned. And we see it, of course, with the pandemonium at Kabul Airport in particular. With we know there are 15,000 Americans to take out, but there are probably many more, 65,000, 70,000 perhaps, of Afghans who are in the pipeline bureaucratically to be accepted under the special visa program, and it's very hard to see how they can be gotten out by that deadline or even beyond it.
It's just a very, it's a heartbreaking story, but I think history tends to look at stories in the current, the present, and long term. And sooner or later, somebody had to make the decision to get out. Obviously, decisions on that were not properly analyzed and thought out from the president on down through the intelligence services, even though they did issue the diplomats on the ground a warning about a week and a half ago. But, you know, you look at it, the Republicans and Democrats have been involved in this fiasco from the beginning. And when you're the president and you decide to actually do what you promised to do, you should have made sure you had as many I's and dotted and T's crossed as you possibly could.
Yeah, it's hard to not come to the conclusion that President Biden, who as Senator Biden, we must remember, was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate. And he, for instance, had some thoroughgoing analyses to offer quite often about international affairs. If you remember, he got roundly scolded in Washington for a plan to pull out of Iraq and divide it into different regions. That was his plan to cut the country up and pull out. And I think he's had a sharp political education, if you like, in what's possible and what's not. He had a very rough time with his suggestions for what should be done in Iraq, and it's hard not to see what's going on now as the product of a man who has a lot of political savvy and can put up with some very tough press, if you like. Though I want to talk about in a moment or two what kind of relations he has with the press. But in the education of Joseph Biden, you've seen this capacity for taking a long view, even when the short view could result in a very, very rough political time. And it's hard not to see the kind of thinking behind what's going on and the decisions that are being made, even the admission, the decision to yes, hear the predictions that the Taliban could take over the country, and indeed would be likely to take it on very quickly, and then saying, well, in the end, we can weather this. One of the interesting political comments I heard over the week was from a Democratic senator, a supporter of President Biden, though a critic of how this whole thing has been handled, positive about the decision to leave, but negative about the way that decision was carried out in resulting in all this chaos. But the political representative was careful to say, but you know, I haven't heard a lot of complaints from my constituency. So it may be a really cynical thing to say, but it's probably the truth that long term. The political damage to Biden will not be lasting. It's, as I say, a cynical thing to say, but I think the logic of the situation impels me to at least air it as a possibility. The interesting thing about how Biden is weathering this in terms of media is that he is, as I say, just over 200 days in office now. And at this point in his presidency, his predecessor, in fact, the man to whom he was vice president, President Obama, at this point, 200 days or so into his presidency, had done about 150 such interviews, one-on-one interviews, as Biden did yesterday with ABC News. At the same point, President Trump had done 50 such one-on-one interviews. President Biden, sitting down with George Stephanopoulos, this was just the ninth such interview he's done. He's being very careful to ration his in-person media appearances, and I think for good reason. We know his staff believe that he can be something of a loose lips to control when he's in that situation, and he doesn't do it as well as Obama did. But more importantly, I think they're relying on a kind of discrete proportion of questioning, if you like, detailed questioning of the presidency, and it's possibly the most cautious thing they could do with the man at the bully pulpit, have him make his pronouncements unquestioned most of the time, the occasional press conference maybe, but in essence these big set pieces are being cut to a minimum.
All right, I guess we do have something to celebrate in journalism though, right?
Well, journalism has done some good things this week under a lot of pressure. Let's have a fanfare for those good things. Yeah, the fanfare this week goes to Ramin Rahman, who is an Afghan. He's 27 years old. He's a young journalist, a photojournalist, who describes himself as progressive and with tattoos, the antithesis of what the Taliban stands for. He felt he had to run and get out of Afghanistan for fairly obvious reasons, and he took only his laptop and phone and nothing else, and he managed to somehow or other to get on board, actually with help from German contacts was how he describes achieving this. He got onto an American C-17 Globemaster military transport plane. And you must have seen this. He took the most extraordinarily striking photograph of the plane's interior, stuffed with hundreds of people, filling its interior from side to side. You must have seen the picture, yes?
Absolutely, yes.
Stunning picture, made all the more dramatic by the fact that it was the inside of a massive transporter plane, and no frills, just shiny metallic walls, and from those walls, left to right, all these people sitting on the floor. Radio talkback between the cockpit and the control tower suggested that they thought they had 800 people in these incredible conditions, but it later checked out to be approximately 640, which is no small payload of humanity, I have to say. They call it floor loading in the business. So passengers were sitting on the floor, hanging on to cargo straps that, of course, were usually used to wrap around tanks and that kind of cargo. But the straps would run from one wall to the opposite wall, and then people would have to hang on to them. So this extraordinary picture, which Ramin filed to the Defense One website. It's a military interest website. And then from there into the mass media all over the world. And, of course, social media picked it up that way. And that single picture, going viral as it did and used by so many mainstream journalism outlets, was, I think, crucial to conveying the pandemonium of people fleeing Afghanistan. So let's hear it for Ramin Rahman. But I want to say also, while we're talking about that, I mean, that was the journalist who escaped. I think it's much more important, perhaps, to recognize the astonishing ongoing work of journalists who are not leaving. And instead, they're bravely sending us what they can out of this unclear and chaotic conditions. All of these terrible... it's a terrible setting to be doing reporting. And then, of course... let's not forget the journalists who are going the other way. There are journalists flying into Kabul, like the BBC's Malik Madusir, doing sterling work, along with all the already in-country-based reporters. And remember that in the process, two photojournalists from the U.S., one from the L.A. Times, another from another American outlet, were beaten up by the Taliban. It's a tough time to be doing this business of ours, and in particular, let's be very clear about this for female journalists too. Clarissa Ward from CNN has had to change very wisely, I think, has had to change into a burqa to do her work on the streets. So let's acknowledge the bravery of people in this trade, for whom it is never easy to report from Afghanistan, but now it's probably more difficult than ever.
It's and I have to, before we wrap up, the American soldiers, the 6,000 American soldiers that came back in to take this mission to its next level, I just give all the credit in the world, and especially to the folks in the Air Force and to the now the armed forces, which are securing that airport. It's a double-edged sword, because not only are they in a combat position where it's highly dangerous because of the Taliban, and you also have crowds of people that want to get past you and get into the airport, and then the safety of flying out of the airport. Our 6,000 or so troops that are there are just doing, so far, a magnificent job of keeping things as under control as they can be.
Yeah, as a logistics force, the U.S. military is probably without parallel in the world, and it's those logistics that are being put fully to the test, and under, of course, as you say, a lot of military pressure, too. Essentially, they are hemmed in entirely and on all sides by Taliban forces, so they're in a defensive stance, and at the same time ferrying 1,000 people an hour, perhaps, out of Kabul, and who knows how it's going to go? But so far, it's picking up speed, and a very effective evacuation is turning out to be what's going on. It's just the background to it, and the speed at which it has taken, supposedly, and it is claimed that it is, by surprise.
All right, and one final thing before we leave, and that is, will folks in Haiti ever get a break?
Well, the poorest country. It's interesting that we're looking at crisis in right across the globe. In one case, one of the poorest countries in the Eastern Hemisphere, and without doubt, Haiti, the absolute poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And sure, yes, on top of an earthquake 10 years ago, which set the scene for the current developments, we've had the assassination of a president, an earthquake, and a hurricane, and tropical storms battering that country. It's not that it's not used to it. It is used to it. But resilience of the country's resilient population is being challenged to the utmost. And heaven knows when Haiti is going to be able to climb out of this latest round of calamities.
I say that because since I've been in radio here in Northwest Connecticut, and that's we signed on our first radio station here back in 1986, we've had a very strong group called Hope for Haiti that has been involved in hospitals, doctors, welfare, getting milk, getting medical supplies, and there's still local residents that are there. So there is a connection from this area to Haiti that is unlike most probably small towns, but it is once again part of the bigger problem in the world, and that is the haves and the have-nots.
As ever, yes, and we're seeing it worked out now in big and small ways in every direction, right down to the argument over whether rich countries should be indulging in a third booster COVID vaccination program for its own citizens versus letting what is being called vaccine equity operate throughout the world. Haiti, of course, has been battered by COVID as well, and many poor countries are angry at the rich countries for not being compassionate and generous towards them in the way that they are towards their own citizens. It's a sad story repeated constantly with every crisis that comes up, I think.
Well, we've got a lot on the table for media to cover, and of course, David will be keeping his eye on it all week long, and we'll speak to him again next week. David, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. Of course, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us, and right here, robinhoodradio.com. Click on Demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.